Now broadcasting the Dr. Nilda Business Foresight Show, positioning your business with strategies for an extraordinary future. Dr. Nilda features expert guests from diverse backgrounds to bring you their stories and strategies that have helped them reach their success. The diversity in industries gives you that panoramic view from an array of industries. They are innovators, thought leaders, trendsetters, and strategists. Here, Dr. Nilda reveals strategies that will position you to be on the cutting edge and be able to do what you love with the people you like, making the profits you want to live the lifestyle that you have dreamed of. And now, here's your host, Dr. Nilda Perez.
Hello, and welcome back to the Dr. Nilda Business Foresight Strategies Show. And I have with me my guest host, which is Rachel. And I had a very special guest coming all the way from Melbourne, Australia. Hello, Bridget.
Hi, and thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. I just can't believe you've taken the time for us because you're really far, and I know you guys are quite a few hours ahead of us. And so this is a big one, and I really appreciate this. But you bring so much worth to the audience that I just couldn't help but beg. So
it's a pleasure to do it. And the time zone actually works out okay. Better than other parts of the world.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. Okay. Bridget Engler is a course director for the Master Design at the Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, Australia. She lectures in strategic foresight, design, strategy, and management, design thinking, and creativity and innovation. Bridget's passion for her field led her to become a board member of the Association of Professional Futurists, which we all know very well. She is a current PhD candidate in strategic foresight, and her research focus is anticipatory thinking in society, technology, and culture. I love it. Welcome, 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 Bridget. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me this morning, this afternoon, this evening. Yeah, thank you for having me today.
It's morning here, so yeah, this is wonderful. Thank you so much. My first question to you is, what attracted you to foresight?
Well, you could say that it was this or an MBA, and I decided that an MBA just had too many Excel spreadsheets and numbers to really keep me interested over the number of units that it required. But it was actually, I think, a more organic process, but also a more intuitive process. I'd been working in brand strategy and design for 15 or something years, and I was working in strategy, I was working in verbal identity, and I wanted to do something else. I had an undergraduate degree and a postgraduate degree that I was working with on a day-to-day basis, and I kept seeing things just cropping around the edges. So what I realize now is that I was seeing weak signals for me as a futurist. And I started exploring what was out there. And it led me to a discussion with a colleague who was working at a large beverage company at the time.
Right.
And we had a chat about some work that he was doing. We had a chat about a brief that I was working on for a new product they were developing. And he talked me through the evolution of the brief as part of, as the result of a foresight process. And I thought, this has got to be something. This is interesting. I then met a couple of other people and I thought, oh, this keeps coming back to me. So I took myself to Swinburne and found myself a few months later enrolled in a Master's of Strategic Foresight. And what I also learned later is that for some futurists, they look for three hits. Once you have something hit you or be put in front of you three times, no longer a weak signal, this is something you need to notice.
That's right.
And I had it from foresight. And I thought, okay. And so I, enrolled in the program and found myself in a space where I felt extremely comfortable, but also sitting on the edge. So there was stuff in there that was new and interesting. There was stuff in there that felt really familiar, and there was stuff in there that really challenged me. So I figured I was probably in the right space. And now I'm teaching foresight alongside Jack Horos.
Oh, wonderful. Awesome. Oh, that's a wonderful story. I love that story. And I love the fact that it was sort of haphazard, although it wasn't. It was divine intervention, although you didn't know it. So, because it's sort of how it happened for me. It was divine intervention. It was not, I was looking for an MBA. and sat down with the dean of, I was in Regent University, sat down with the dean of the school, who, as I was telling him what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go, said, "You are the perfect candidate for Foresight Strategies." And I was like, "What is that?" And before I knew it, I was involved in a program that I have to tell you has forever changed my life, because I'm so fascinated by futures and by all the potential, and just being able to see the world from that broad perspective.
Yeah.
I just can't get enough of it. Can't get enough. Yeah. So I get it. I get the bug.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I found myself sitting in meetings talking about brands that were going into the market for a few months or had a shorter lifespan. And I kept thinking about the consequences of that. And not just from a, well, this is a trial product or it's an innovation and therefore we want to see what happens with it. This could lead to a bigger project with a brand or a bigger suite of brands. But it was that, what are we using to understand how a brand might emerge in a market, and what does that brand scape look like 5 years out? Yeah. And I was just looking for something more, and felt that the other programs I was looking at for education weren't going to give it to me. And yeah, just a whole lot of things came together. It was serendipitous, and it was kind of intuitive. And now that I look at it, I can see that there actually was a path I was following.
Right.
And I ended up in the right space. And yeah, and this, I think, also goes back to future isn't predetermined. There is no one future. I could have done an MBA. I could have done a degree in something else entirely. I could have gone and taken a job in a design agency rather than running a consulting business. I could have done a whole load of things. Instead, I made a choice, and it took me on a path which feels right and feels comfortable. And I really enjoy. I love my work. I love teaching. I love doing the industry work I do, and I love research. So, yeah, I've ended up in the right space for the moment, anyway.
Right. Well, because even that will evolve. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the PhD is one of those evolving things, because
you think,
well, what's a PhD got to do with research and industry work, and what's a PhD going to do to support, I suppose, industry collaboration or a work outside academia? And I think the depth of knowledge and the rigor that comes with that level of study and exploration means that it's valued with industry and business. It's not just an academic piece. It's not just a bit of work that you produce and go, oh, that, now I've ticked the PhD box. There's actually a lot of skill and knowledge that goes into the PhD. And I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about the process. PhD.
Exactly. The process is, it really is. It's vigorous and yet fascinating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Well, my question is, what is the connection between futures thinking and design? I mean, I can see how you were going for your MBA and then you kind of changed to, you know, adding futures thinking to design. I mean, I kind of see it, but what is the connection? You see, because I see futures thinking as almost like another way to create.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the connections back to design, that design manifests in something, whether it be a product or a service or a brand or an organization design. It manifests in some kind of tangible or intangible outcome, so service or product or whatever. And futures is the creation of futures to come. And I think that is a really obvious connection. For me, there was I don't want to say disconnection or the disconnect, but a little bit of interesting tension, that friction between design and foresight, which meant that we were often talking about designing things for long term, but actually not really for the long term. So long term was a couple of years or maybe 6 months or maybe 5 to 10 years for a business strategy. But those things have longevity. And the more I kept saying to smaller organizations, small businesses or startups or not-for-profit that were still relatively small by number or by activity, that you know, every big brand started small. I kept thinking, you know, what did Coca-Cola think about when it was a small brand? Did it actually use, like, I know that they do use foresight within their organization now.
Yes.
But it's this, what are we designing and what is the lifespan of that? And what are the consequences of that? And I also felt a little bit of dissatisfaction, not with design thinking, because I think design thinking is a great process and it's a great set of tools, and it can be deployed really well in organizations for lots of different things. But I felt that there was a bit missing from design thinking as a process, or a typical innovation or creative process in an organization, where there wasn't a lot of attention to the longer time span. So we might have an immediacy around delivering innovation or a new product or service or getting something into the market, but that foresight piece wasn't always thought through, even though there were so many different voices and so many different perspectives brought into a process. It still felt it was a bit lacking. And then I think I saw a lot of emergent conversations around design thinking being a way to create better futures. And absolutely it is. But if the foresight piece isn't there, if the futures thinking and the futures tools aren't within that process or part of that process, or the foresight work hasn't been done before that design thinking piece takes place, it's an opportunity lost. It's an opportunity to think 25, 50 years out. It's an opportunity to bring different realities and different perspectives into a process that is really well understood and really well used, mostly. For me, this kind of isn't the thing. Design thinking is not this global panacea. It's not the pill that we can take and expect everything to be fixed. And right. Foresight's not hard. Yeah. And I think it felt like there was a little bit missing around that. So there's a connection, a clear connection, in the sense designers bring stuff to life. So they get stuff out of people's heads and put it in front of you. That right. They get to you know, use the phrase, get it off the whiteboard and into the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And right. That's phenomenal. I can't do the work I do without people to bring stuff to life. What I carry in my head is my imagination. I'm not a designer, so you know, I struggle with anything more than a stick figure or a Word document. Doesn't mean I'm not creative, but I need a design. And so I think that's the other thing, that there is this connection between the imagination and those futures that can be envisioned and actually making them happen.
Okay. Awesome. Okay.
So my next question is what are the challenges in teaching foresight?
I think it's the opening up of mind, and the challenges are around the methods and tools, asking people to think 25, 50 years out when we often have trouble thinking about what we're doing next week. Some of the language of foresight can be, it can be obscure, it can be obtuse, and we live in a world that tends to prioritize and privilege certainty and guarantees and knowing over uncertainty and emergence and trusting that what you are doing will bring about a result. And I actually think that's where there is another link to the design process, because as a client, you brief a designer to do something and you have no real idea of what they're going to produce until it gets produced. And there's a lot of emergent properties around a design process. There's a lot of iteration. Same in foresight. You don't know what it's going to be until you get there. And that is kind of tricky. And then there's just the challenges of more processes, more tools. I sat in many, many conversations with Joe Voros and Peter Hayward, where it was another day, another model. But it's back to the, here's a model, use it. If it serves you, great. If it doesn't, will there be something else?
Right.
I think it depends on who's in the room and what interest they have in thinking longer term. Someone may want, no, I think everyone has the capacity to be a futures thinker. Everyone has a capacity for anticipatory thinking.
Because it's very imaginative. I have to tell you, I think we can, I would feel comfortable saying that Walt Disney was a futurist. Because he had this imagination and he saw the future. And he was able to develop things today that are going to be future centric, So he always had that. He was always so many steps ahead of everyone else. So I think that it's fair to say that he was a futurist. He was a futurist thinker.
Very much.
And then he coupled that with design. Imagine, you know.
Yeah.
So I would agree that, you know, although there's a lot of uncertainty, you have this opportunity to imagine all of the possibilities. But isn't that how things have happened? Isn't that how Google, isn't that how Facebook, isn't that how all of these people have made things happen? It's been an imagination. It never existed before.
I was going to say, this is often what I say to my students, that we often, as people, have imagined things that we might find useful or could be interesting, but we don't bring them to play. We don't actually create them. We don't make them real in our lives. And designers do that. And we didn't ask for the internet. We didn't ask for electric vehicles. They were depictions of alternative ways of communicating, of ways of doing, alternative ways of doing business, alternative ways of transportation.
Transport, right.
We need these images of alternatives in order to prompt us into thinking yes. And it then is down to the individual to decide, you know, do we want that? Is that actually a good thing for us?
Right.
And that world presented so many different futures in the work that he led. Yeah, it's nice to see that people are like that. Yeah, I'll pick that up. And we have choices that we can say, you know, and in design, we've had this discussion about, you know, print is dead. Print is dying. Print's not going to happen. We're still printing stuff.
Right.
Print is not dead.
At least not while I'm alive, because I need print. Right. I'm very, you know, technological. Everything we run in the business, everything is high tech. However, I still need a book. I still need a highlighter. I still, there are certain things that I need in print. My magazines, I feel more comfortable reading them in print. My books, I feel more comfortable with print. The Bible, I feel more comfortable reading that in print. And all of this stuff is available, you know, I guess it's good for maybe the millennials. I don't know. I'm not comfortable with it yet.
No, well, I've got two research projects at the moment that are not part of my PhD. They're part of my research work at Swinburne. And both of those projects are distinctly different. One, they're both related to health, but one is more in the aging and older and mental health space. The other is in sexual health. And what we're finding in both is that digital has a role to play, but print has a significant role to play. If we take print communication out of the equation, that communication equation for both of these particular projects, there are very specific, very important groups of people who use those products and need those products who won't get them. Print is critical. And with one particular project, print is so critical that in some of the research we've been doing, we're starting to understand that for some people, print is their daily connection to the rest of the world. The print medium is their way of getting news. They can't do digital, they can't do electronic delivery, and because of their condition. And okay, so this print is dead, digital is everything, doesn't work for everyone. I know it's a kind of extreme example, it's almost a naive example, but it is one of those mantras that you hear around foresight and design. Oh, this is dead. We've got the top 10 predictions. This is what's going to be big next year. We can choose whether those things are going to be big by choosing to use them or not.
There we go. Absolutely. Because if there's a demand, there's a supply.
Yeah.
Exactly. So going back really quickly, I'm sorry, to the whole challenges of teaching foresight. I think that if we don't stay in that open mindset of, you know, like Dr. Gary said, what if we,
right?
And if people like Walt Disney, Google, all these companies that have said that very question, what if we, you know, they wouldn't be where they are today.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Exactly. But, and in the classroom, when you ask that, what if we did this, you might be looking at a group of 15 to 20 students from 11 or 12 different countries around the world. So that we changes, because there is no one we. And you then get into a discussion around, well, you know, for we as a people, which is a voice expressed by a student from a particular part of the world or from a particular organization, that we is distinct and needs to be heard. And then someone else will express their we, and you suddenly start to open a space for dissent, which is, for me, one of the most interesting parts in a foresight process, but open up the space for the conversation. Right. So what are the things that we want versus what another we wants?
Right. And it is based on their experience. Because a different country, a different organization, a different community has a different experience. So that we comes with, you know, what if we comes with that experience? So they're bringing that experience to the table. Mm-hmm. So there's so much more to work with when you're actually working a project, when you're actually working on making change, because you're getting it from different perspectives and different experiences.
Absolutely. And that makes it maybe more challenging, but it also makes it more fun, and it makes it, I think, more powerful, not just in terms of a foresight process, but for the people participating. So their learning is much deeper. And a lot of the learning comes from within themselves as opposed to a tool or a process that is introduced in a classroom. And I think that's another part about foresight that often doesn't get as explored, that your personal journey is as important as the learning journey that you're going on, whether that be in a formal education setting or learning about something going through a process at work.
Right. So I want to know a little bit more. I want to take a couple steps back and hear a little bit more about design. I have a niece who is a graphic designer. And of course, she works with me, and I am foresight. So I keep telling her, there, you know, we can marry this. We can couple this, because she already has that vivid imagination. She looks at something. I'll give her a project, and she says, "Tell me what you want." And I was like, "I want this, this, and this." And so she'd go away and she'd give me that. And then one day she was like, "Can I have like creative autonomy? Can I like just go crazy?" And I said, "I don't know. What does go crazy look like?" She said, "Just do it." And came up with an incredible concept that I never thought of, and was able to really, because she had that creative, she already had that creativity and that imagination in her. So when you talk about design, is that what you're saying? And is that what you're coupling with foresight?
I think a lot of the time, yes. I'm also talking about designers having the capacity for a more developed futures thinking. So that anticipatory thinking capability or capacity for designers to bring that to every project. So to be asking, I suppose, bigger and maybe deeper questions about the projects they're working on. So for some people, that might be as fundamental as, do I actually want to work on this project? Do I really want to take this brief from this client? Do I want to engage in that kind of work? Does it align with my values and my practice, and is it a space I want to be in? Or it could be as small, and it's actually not a small question, but a smaller consideration, which is, well, if I talk to my client about this and say to them, don't tell me about the next 12 months, but tell me about the next 5 years or 10 years, what is the entire life cycle of this product? Or what do you think, what is your strategy for 10 years from now? And then do a bit of backcasting from there.
Right.
That might help the design process. But I do think it is as fundamental as giving designers the capacity to imagine things differently and asking the right questions as part of the briefing process. So not the, we need a brochure to do this, but we need a way to help people understand more about this particular issue, or we need to find a way to improve the design so that this group of people use it. We need to find a way to design this so that people with this level of ability can engage with it. We need to find a way for this group of people to access a website using a particular means. It is very much back to that more open-ended approach that you were talking about before, what if we? And a lot of the time, that question from a design thinking process, which is how might we, that is a useful question, because it's not a why or who question, but it is a how that challenges the designer. And I think sometimes there is a distinction between futures and design, which is much more about the why and the who versus the what and the how. The design, you could argue, maybe plays around the what and the how more than it does the why and the who. But if you don't have a why and a who in your design process, then you could really design anything. You don't understand or need the real, you know, what is that, what is the reason for doing this, and who you are designing it for, then you could create anything and someone will kind of pick it up.
Right. Okay. I love that. Awesome. So tell me, what kind of projects are you working on now?
Well, I've got a rather big project, which is to develop a new condom. So I'm part of Project Geldom, which is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and we are working on using a tough hydrogel to develop a condom that you can't feel, which should in theory make a lot more people want to use it. So it's linked to a bigger strategic initiative around preventing the spread of AIDS or halting the spread of AIDS globally, and condoms are still the most effective barrier protection you have. So it's not about contraception, but it is about sexual health. So we're looking at what we can do with a tough hydrogel to make people actually want to use it. But that involves looking at human behavior. It also is the anticipatory process of what do you do if you introduce this as an intervention into a community? How does a community respond to that? How do we do that in a culturally appropriate way? Where do we need to be sensitive to people's issues around sexual health? What can you and can't you discuss? And then we're a team of researchers from universities in Australia, and we're really passionate about our work, but we have to engage with someone for them to decide whether they want to hear what we have to say about our product. So there's very much a human-centered and futures-oriented process in the work that we do.
Right. And then also they bring with that, they also bring their own biases and thoughts and feelings about,
Assumptions and biases are the things that you come up against in design an awful lot.
Yeah.
And obviously in foresight as well. And that's where there are tools like causal layer analysis, which I really enjoy using because they help clear some of those assumptions. There's also a tool that I was teaching, learnt it from Dory Tunstall, who's now at OCAD in Canada, which is a process called QAMI, Questions, Assumptions, Methods and Evidence. And one of the things that that tool lays fair and square on the table is the assumptions. So the assumptions that you bring to your research process, and to get them out and understand how they might be challenged or start to identify assumptions that you didn't even know were assumptions and biases.
Right.
Yeah, we have assumptions about how a condom might be used.
Right.
As me, I'm female. I live in Australia. I'm nearly 50. I have my assumptions about condoms, but it's not about me. I have to design for other people, and empathy is only going to get me so far. I need to work with the people who are going to be possibly using these condoms.
Exactly. I love it. Awesome. So you do outreach, you go to the community, you go to the people. How do you do that?
At the moment, we are using some neuro testing to determine responses to the material. And we will go into the field at some point this year, which is really exciting. So we'll be able to engage with communities in various parts of the world. So that is in planning at the moment.
Okay. That sounds fascinating. That's fascinating. Yes, that's fascinating. And, again, because you are doing the human, you're creating something. And by the same time, you're doing the human interaction. You're able to do outreach and speak to the people and understand where they are, pretty much like we were speaking before. Who are they? What do they want? What's their experience? Because they're going to speak to you from that experience. They can't speak to you from anything else. So as they speak to you from their experience, then you can understand and be able to design best for them.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Because there's no way that I can go into a community and say, here's this awesome new product. It's beautifully branded. Don't you love the way it looks? Isn't it amazing? Now use it. If they've never used one before, it doesn't matter how good it is. It doesn't matter how attractive it is.
Or they come with those assumptions like, this is uncomfortable. I don't like it. I don't want it. It doesn't fit my lifestyle.
It's
not cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm never going to get AIDS, you know.
Yeah.
So,
that comes up.
Exactly. So you see, those are the things that you have to deal with. So how do you make something, you know, appealing? How do you make it something that's trendy that they would want to, you know, that they would want to do? Rachel and I, we had an interview the other day. We were talking about, remember that toy that spins, that spinning toy? Yes.
Yeah.
So that was created for, a mom created that for her son who had autism. So yes. His sensory level, that helped. But there was another kid that thought it was cool. And that became all of the rage. So, So just imagine, like, so you never know. That's why it's so important to bring your, to be able to connect with the audience that you think would need it or would want it. And sometimes just venture out to possibly people that you may not think may want it, but there's a very good chance that they would.
Yeah. Right? And doing it in a way, this is about that meaningfulness in design. So design is a way of making human values and human meaning, and what it is to be human, which is what Dori Tunstall has said a number of times, that design is a way of bringing that into reality in the world. And so, yeah, this is all about human behavior, our preferences, the things that we're comfortable with, the things that we're not comfortable with, and helping people understand how that all kind of fits together in a way that is that better world, which is then the connection to better futures for everyone. Oh,
right. Awesome. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you so much for being here, for sharing with us. I tip my hat to you. I remember that whole doctoral trend, that whole doctoral journey. And I don't want to think back. It was amazing because when I was done, Bridget, I remember my last course when I was finished, I was like, did I learn anything? Am I supposed to go out and implement that stuff that I just didn't learn? And it's amazing how it comes to you. You don't realize, you know, and you think that your learning is such a rapid pace and you're taking all of this information and there's no way that you'll ever really know it. And quite the contrary, it was really, really fascinating. So, but I remember the journey and I tip my hat to you.
I've been told by a few people that it's not just about the PhD. It's not just the thesis. It's the journey along the way. So the journey is as important as the destination. And I know for some people it's the destination, for others it's just the journey, but I see, I don't want to say a balance, but I can see that they're two distinct things.
Right.
But they're also that kind of parasymbiotic relationship.
It changes your life. It really, it changes your life. Unlike anything else that I've ever experienced, it really changes your life. Your whole perspective of thinking, it changes your life. So, alrighty then. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you for taking your time. Thank you for taking your afternoon for us. This is huge. Thank you so much. And we look forward to having more conversations. We're both members of the Association of Professional Futurists. So we will continue this conversation, even if it's off the air.
That would be great. I really appreciate the opportunity to have a chat with you both. Thank you very, very much indeed.
Okay. Thank you. All right, everyone. So this is this segment of Business Foresight Strategies. And next week, we'll have another futurist with us. Thank you so much for staying tuned and being with us. Thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Foresight Strategy Show. You can hear host Dr. Nilda, co-host Rachel with feature guests every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Facebook Live or anytime on demand. Visit www.drnildaperez.com/show. For more information, sign up to our Foresight Strategies Insider newsletter, a $10 value for free, at www.drnildaperez.com/newsletter.